Real quick, before we get into the show, I wanted to share a new service called Getida that Ken and I have been using that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for firing the man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?
We can't get in through the front door. We'll go through the back. We can't get through the back. We'll go down the street. We'll break through the window. Whatever it takes, we will get to that person, or we will go through hell or high water for you. That's what my team is trained to do. And my team, one of the criteria is you actually have to care. Like, you can't not care. Pretty much any state that matters, the tax is being collected by Amazon by law, and it's being remitted by Amazon. And it is Amazon's responsibility, primary responsibility as a taxpayer, to remit those taxes under what's called the Marketplace Facilitator Law.
Welcome, everyone, to the Firing the Man podcast, a show for anyone who wants to be their own boss. If you sit in a cubicle every day and know you are capable of more, then join us. This show will help you build a business and grow your passive income streams in just a few short hours per day. And now your hosts, serial entrepreneurs David Schomer and Ken Wilson.
Welcome, everyone, to the Firing the Man podcast. On today's episode, we are joined by Paul Raffleson, an e-commerce law expert and the most cited resource in the congressional antitrust investigation into Amazon's mistreatment of sellers on the platform. Paul is the founding partner at Raffleson Law Firm, the number one law firm for online businesses facing legal challenges and digital sellers looking for the best deal when exiting their businesses. In 2021, they facilitated 60-plus online business exits, realizing over $238 million for their clients. Paul is also the founder of Online Merchants Guild, a trade association that enables thousands of online sellers to voice their concerns on various legal issues affecting them, where he volunteers as executive director. He has 15-plus years of experience as an attorney, and he paid his law degree at Villanova Law School by selling video games on Amazon. So a true e-commerce seller. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I appreciate that intro. Very humbling way to describe my experience, and I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I actually sold DVDs initially. It was DVDs. The video games came later, but it was DVDs. I can tell you how I almost bankrupted Circuit City with my DVD scheme, my DVD hack.
Awesome. Well, I hope we get into that during this podcast. So for listeners that are not familiar with you, can you tell a little bit about yourself and what led you to a career in helping e-commerce sellers like us?
Yeah, it was all by accident. That's the reality. It was totally unintentional. It was a blog post I wrote for another consultant in the Amazon space who used to work with my wife. So my wife actually worked for Seller Performance. You may have heard of that department at Amazon. Yeah, this is years and years ago, and I was doing a lot of corporate law. So I worked for a lot of big companies in my life. I worked for the man. I worked for law firms. I worked for big tax firms. I worked for Microsoft. I worked for Walmart. I lived in Arkansas, and I worked for General Electric. And so most of my life, I was doing big corporate legal stuff, a lot of tax stuff. And right around the time, we had just helped GE move to Boston. So GE used to be based in Connecticut, and they wanted to move everything to Boston. And basically, that whole, you remember the Amazon HQ2 playbook? You remember that whole thing?
Yeah.
Well, they borrowed that from us. That was our playbook. We did that first, the GE. When we wanted to move our headquarters out of Connecticut, we went around state to state and did a little, you know, a little show. And you know, in Indiana, put a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, hey, GE, friends don't let friends pay high taxes, come to Indiana. You know, there was and the head of tax at Amazon, who's actually, you know, probably kind of like the person who used to be, anyway, somebody I used to work for, knew very well, you know, that it's a very small community, especially in tax and tax litigation, tax planning. And so that's kind of my background. And so after GE moved to Boston and was going through some restructuring, I kind of decided to take a step away. Like, this just wasn't going the direction I wanted it. You know, my time at GE was kind of sad. It was like, here's one of the biggest companies in the world. I was recruited to work there. They came to me from Walmart. This is the being called up to the Yankees, although I'm not a Yankees fan, but you get the analogy, right, of companies. And all I did there was, you know, I was a part of like this dismantling, right? Right. When I got there, we were selling the TV station. Like, GE used to own NBC and Universal Studio, gone, right? Then the entire financial division, which was more than half the profit of the company, gone, right? Appliances, gone. Like, I mean, it was just like everything gone. But till what was left of GE was really just anything that spins, right? So, you know, turbines and airplane engines. But the bulk of the company was gone. So I took a step back and I was trying to figure life out. And all of a sudden, an Amazon consultant reaches out to me and says, hey, a bunch of my clients are being told that they owe their life savings back taxes. Do you guys remember this 2017-ish, 2016, this whole like, you owe all these, you should have been collecting sales tax your whole life on Amazon. And me having some familiarity with sales tax law, but also a ton of familiarity with the Constitution of the United States, because I actually teach a constitutional law course on tax in New York. I was like, well, that's all wrong. And I just wrote a blog post about how wrong that was and how, you know, just by the mere use of fulfillment by Amazon, they didn't establish nexus. And that even if it did establish nexus, you're not really the retailer under state law that Amazon is. And sort of throw these arguments out there that, you know, Aguilera and TaxJar didn't like. So it wasn't received well by the community, since they were the number one sponsors of events back then. But it got traction. And so people got to know me. And it was in that experience I realized that, you know, what had happened, that, you know, when I was an Amazon seller in the early 2000s, there was no FBA. Like, you weren't going to not be a lawyer to sell on Amazon. Like, this was a side hustle. Right. I had no idea coming back into it and looking at what the community had become, what e-commerce had become in 2017, and realizing what FBA did, you know, how it became the sort of, you know, railroad of e-commerce. Like, how it's like, no, my God, this is making real viable businesses. This is taking, you know, and there's all these regular people who are now making a lot of money, who are basically, you know, saying F you. Am I allowed to say that? F you to the man?
You bet.
They are. Yeah. But like your point, because I love what you're, well, the way you do, you're 100% spot on, because that's my point. It's like a lot of our clients don't have college degrees, right? They don't have fancy degrees. They don't have, you know, and they just saw the opportunity to hustle and hustle their way to salaries that, you know, prior to e-commerce, you never could imagine them. They could never imagine themselves making, right? A lot of our clients are people who got, you know, fired during the 2008 financial crisis and started building something then. So by the time I got to know them, they actually had bought really valuable businesses through a lot of grit, right? Anyway, so now all these people are being told they owe their life savings. And I'm like, that's wrong. But I also realized that they don't really, there's a lot they're missing, that there's this new thing out there, this new phenomenon. I didn't know what to call it. So I called it the global small business. I said, this is what this is. I said, this is what we've created in e-commerce. And this is what I told the Supreme Court in my Wayfair amicus brief, which you can look up and read. I said, there's this new phenomenon in the world called a global small business. It's an oxymoron. Prior to the internet, that would be an oxymoron. How can you be a global small business in the 1980s? How could you do it? Right? You need a lot of capital, right? Like, if you want it to be global, right? It implies you have an extensive reach in capital. But no, with e-commerce, you can be a global business in your kitchen table. You can be a kitchen table enterprise that's importing from China, that's selling in multiple countries, right? Even interstate commerce. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, the lawyer who you would hire, like, for example, like if you're starting an LLC, like the lawyer you might hire to help you open up a tea shop in the middle of Main Street may not be the kind of lawyer you need when you're selling across the entire country and across the world. It's just not. And there really is no law firm designed to provide global and multi-state perspective for small businesses, right? Like, I'm not a lawyer with all my training prior to going into this field. I'm not a lawyer. Like, if you asked me in 2016, would you ever see yourself having clients that do under $1 billion? You know, I'm being a little facetious, but even like under 100 million or under 10 million, I'd probably say no. Like, why would they need? I'm not that lawyer. I'm not the lawyer for that kind of a business. I'm a lawyer for huge multinationals. That's what I'm paid to do. I've paid to solve very complex problems for huge multinationals. But now all of a sudden, these micro multinationals are having these same problems and nobody was there to help them. And that's the opportunity and curse, I guess, that I kind of befell upon me, that I decided that I wanted to do something about it. So I built a practice around that, around, you know, there was another lawyer that was doing, you know, if you're suspended on Amazon and, you know, and now we do quite a lot of that. But back then I'm like, I don't really even need to do that because like, who's doing like, how do you form an LLC? Like, what's the difference between the legal Zoom LLC and this LLC or what? When do you need a trademark? And what do you do about copyright? Like, nobody was just answering the basics. Nobody was just covering the basics. Like, it was all about like suspension law. And like, that's great. But like, there's just some legal hygiene that's just missing here that I was just trying to fill in that gap. You know, how do you do taxes? Like, what is the right answer for taxes? Is it, do you really have to register your, you know, you're working at your kitchen table, you make 60 grand a year. Do you really have to register 12,000 jurisdictions and hire, you know, the same accounting firms as Google to do your taxes? Is that really the answer? Probably not. So that's kind of it. I'm going to pause here because you probably noticed I like to ramble and rant. So I'm going to stop. But that's the gist of what I,
sure. So yeah, interesting story. I like how Paul, you've sold on Amazon before. You kind of saw, you know, that hey, there's a problem here, and it's at like a micro instead of a macro or in size of scale, and that you kind of pitched in and helped out, and it was right in kind of your wheelhouse to say. I'm excited to dig into some questions here. So what are some legal trends that online sellers need to know about, and why do we need a voice? Why is it important for us to have a voice in the legislation?
Absolutely. Okay. So, I mean, the legal trends are really fascinating. So there's just a lot of laws out there. So, I mean, take something like, you know, California's Prop 65. Have you heard of that law? California Proposition 65?
I've seen it, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Can we get a refresher on
that? So basically, the law is basically, it's a California rule that says that you're supposed to, if the product contains any certain type of chemical, then you're supposed to put this little yellow warning sticker on it. It says, you know, may cause cancer. It's, you know, I'm paraphrasing, right? And it's kind of a running joke in California because it's on everything. Like if you rent a car in California, it's going to be on the glove box, right? It's everywhere. And it's a California specific thing. So it's like, but that law affects every one of us because we sell on Amazon, and when we sell on Amazon, we're touching 50 states. And so there actually is a Prop 65 portal on Amazon, right? And it's like, how do we know that? How do we know as small sellers, like, this is why you need to have somebody in your corner who's watching out for you. Did you know that there's a, you know, we, this is a real case. Like we had a client who had to spend, you know, pay up. I think we got it down. I think his friend paid like $500,000, but one who hired us, we got it down at 10 grand for selling shower faucets, shower heads that were compliant in 49 states, but not California. Price gouging. You know, we took a price gouging court case to federal court because we said, you know, hey, hold on a second. Like, how did we be in price gouging territory when we don't set a price? You know, these are state laws, they're not federal laws, right? Every state has its own percentage of whether or not, you know, is it 5% price gouging, is it 10% that's price gouging? But I'm on Amazon and I'm setting one price for the nation. How can you possibly hold us accountable for this? Hold Amazon accountable. Like, we weren't anti-price gouging, we're like, that's fine, hold it. You know, Amazon's a really big company and that's the right answer. But it's like there's just so many legal questions. And because it's internet commerce, and you look at Congress, and you remember when Congress a couple of years ago, you remember when Mark Zuckerberg testified on Capitol Hill and they asked him, and said, you know, and the guy asked him, it was, Senator Hatch. He was like, how do you make money on Facebook when you don't charge for it? And he's like, we run ad center. And then he asked him again, he's like, you run ads? And he's like trying not to laugh. I mean, part of the problem is that like that's the laws that are being made by those people. There was a tax law that was just passed recently in California that's based off of a national tax initiative to get us because it wasn't enough to get us with sales tax. They want to get us with income tax. They want you to pay income tax in every state. And you know what genius ideas they came up with? Like cookie nexus, right? Like if you put a cookie on someone's computer, you have nexus. Or my favorite was that if you have a chatbot, if you have a robot chatbot that's doing customer service on your computer, that is the equivalent of having a customer service agent hired in the state. It's like having, so if a person in Massachusetts talks to your digital chatbot, you're deemed to have a Massachusetts employee. Therefore, you are subject to Massachusetts income tax. I mean, just morons. Just, you know what I mean? And this is happening. And unfortunately, we're actually doing a really bad job of getting in front of it because we're not funded. Like, we don't have enough money. And this is what I do. This is the volunteer side of what I do. And it's almost like what I do to make a living as a lawyer funds the more fun stuff, which is the stuff I'm trying to do through the nonprofit pro bono. Because that's the stuff that's interesting. That's the stuff that, you know, as a lawyer, you know, this is how you make history, right? Like, we won a court case in Pennsylvania a couple weeks ago. And if, you know, remember all these years, if you have your inventory in the Amazon warehouse, it's Nexus. Well, first court case ever to actually ask the question, Pennsylvania said, absolutely not. If you have your inventory in a Pennsylvania warehouse, it is not Nexus if it's Amazon's warehouse, because you didn't put it there on purpose. It just ended up there, which is what our point is. In order for something to be, in order to have a Nexus in a state, whether it's for tax or any other purpose being sued, you have to deliberately direct business activities towards that specific state. It can't just be throwing your stuff in the stream of commerce, that's the term, and then having sort of land and wash ashore. Because that would be every state, right? You'd be sued in Alaska. So the whole idea of this purposeful availment, we finally took that to court just in September. First, we're after how many years of this, we finally had a court. Court sucks. It takes that long to get questions like that answered. And yet we're still fighting the same question in California right now. We're still fighting it. So that's the kind of stuff that we're up against, and that's the stuff we like to do. So that's sort of like the legal issues. And then there's intellectual property. Like, you know, are you guys, you know, tell me from your audience's perspective, are you more resellers? Are you private label? Are you both? Who do you kind of, you know, see as, you know, because I can get into it from either side or both.
Yeah, I would say Ken and I are almost exclusively private label. And I would say a good bit of our audience are private label, probably some resellers, drop shippers in there. But yeah, I think private label makes up a good bit of our audience.
If you want tips and strategies on how to start, grow, and monetize your business online, check out the Digital Revolution podcast with Eli Adams. We interview digital experts from around the world that share their personal stories. They talk about what they're currently working on and where they see the future going. But most importantly, they share tactics in their specific area of expertise with the hope of helping you improve your digital presence online. You can listen to the Digital Revolution podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, or simply click on the link in the show notes below.
All right, I was hoping you'd say resellers because I have a really good reseller story. I don't want to tell you that one, but let me tell you some private label things. So private label, the classic things are, you know, all the stuff we were dealing with last year with reviews, right? You know, with Amazon, the seller code of conduct, and how did we generate reviews? But where's this? This is coming from the FTC, right? I mean, the FTC is the one that's dictating to Amazon that, hey, you're not allowed to have incentivized positive reviews. Well, no kidding. That doesn't seem right. Incentivized positive review. Now, is it as bad? Does it necessarily mean you shouldn't have an incentivized review? Like, hey, thanks for your time. Here's a review. Thank you for taking the time to leave a review. Here's a coupon. That's not as, now the FTC's website says you shouldn't do it. It doesn't necessarily say you can't do it. It's kind of, that's much grayer, right? Or my favorite is the filtered reviews. They're very, so you can't do the filtered reviews, which is, if you know what that is, right? That's like, you know, how was your experience 1 to 5? And if it's anything less than 5, you know, if it's a 5, you say, great, leave us a review. And if it's anything less than 5, you say, tell us what went wrong. What could we do to make it right? Right. The idea is you don't want the people who said less than 5 going to lead a review. Now, that may sound really manipulative, but let me ask you a question. You guys ever seen a car commercial before?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Like Bob Smith Toyota or something, sure, in your town, some generic, right? And usually what happens, a lot of people coming out and they'll say, you know, the cute couple come out and say, we just got taken at Bob Jones Toyota. They ripped us off. No, it's always the opposite, right? It's always like, we just got a great deal at Bob Smith Toyota. right? So they're not asking the couple with a bad experience to give that testimonial on TV. So I'm not sure I actually agree with the FTC or Amazon's conclusion that review filtering is per se bad. But right now, what Amazon does is their position is if the FTC doesn't like it, if the government doesn't like it, they're going to take that position. That, you know, they're looking out to themselves. So they're going to take that position. And that's going to affect our ability to do those things that help drive traffic, reviews, and right. So it's like, if we're not in the forefront of the legislation of what is, you know, what is and isn't allowed, then it's going to affect what Amazon is. It's going to affect the seller code of conduct. Does that make sense? Do you see that correlation, right? If the FTC is saying this is wrong, or if the FTC is saying we could potentially interpret this as wrong, Amazon is going to play it safe and say, we're just going to treat it as wrong and say this is a violation of seller code of conduct. So stuff like that. But we could be on the forefront of this. We could also be developing a seller. You know, one of my things is I didn't love the legislation that the FTC proposed, you know, that Congress proposed after the antitrust. I didn't think it was useful. I didn't think it was going to be super helpful. And I don't want to get into full detail of that. But what I didn't want is, what about a seller bill of rights? You know, we did something like this in California where, you know, which led to the 72-hour notice rule, right? What about a seller bill of rights, right? If you're trying to protect the sellers, Congress, how about a bill of rights? How about some recognition and some protection for the American sellers? Do you know how many China-based clients we have? Not very many, because China-based clients don't care. They're not worried about complying with it. They're not worried if there's lead in the product. They don't care. They just disappear. And it's, the more rules and regulations that Congress and the states put on the American sellers, all they're doing is giving an advantage to the foreign-based sellers. And we're trying to get, it's like, we can't deliver that message. So there's a lot of work to be done, in my opinion. Now, some of the cool stuff we did to the resellers, and I love this. Now, I'm still working this on the broader side, but there's been this just out of control intellectual property issue that's been going on for years where it's like, you know, if I'm, you know, North Face, I don't want you reselling on my listing. And I get it. And there are ways to enforce that. And there's a gray area of law around that. But what you don't do, what you never do, what you must not do, is you must not use Amazon's tools to knock off somebody from your listing if they're selling the authentic product, right? Now, if they're selling fakes, absolutely. That's what those are for. But if it's just like, hey, this got the product at TJ Maxx is on my listing, that's not of the valid use of an Amazon brand registry tool, right? Or you can't claim counterfeit. And we've just been dealing with so much of it. It's been so distracting that it's like, you know, we've been overrun with reseller clients who are just every day they're getting them. And we finally got Amazon to see that, hey, look, it is written in your policies that this is an abuse, that Amazon supports the right to resell, aka the first sale doctrine. And so therefore it is not appropriate to use an Amazon tool to claim counterfeit. And when you do that, that is a violation of, you know, Amazon terms of service. It's considered abuse, brand registry abuse. It's considered a violation of seller code of conduct. So what are you going to do about it? Well, this year, I mean, this, you know, just having gotten set up with it, we finally got Amazon to start taking brand registry rights away. So now where we go to brands and the brands file these claims against our clients and we say, look, there's two ways we can go about this. You can either retract or we can have your brand registry rights removed. And I could pull them right out. Like the Predator pulls your skull, you know, the movie Predator, maybe you've never seen that movie, but like, yeah, that's how I describe, like, I can grab your brand registry rights, pull them around, wear them around me, wherever, you know, which way do you want to do this? And they'll say, well, your sellers have to agree to stop selling. And say, it's not a negotiation, it's a currency.
Yeah.
There are other ways you can go around scaring sellers not to sell on your listing, there are not to sell your products. There are other ways, and I'm not saying those are right or wrong, but they don't involve the use of Amazon's brand registry tools. So those are the fun things that we get to deal with in our legal practice. And that's before you can get into exits and fun stuff of like selling your, you know, finally getting to sell your business. But those are, you know, so what I always like to say is I think for us, what we do well, you know, especially since we have like a program, it's like $99 a month to talk to a lawyer, like anytime you need one, just for quick questions and covers your suspensions. We even have a program like that. It's that ounce of legal prevention, right? That preventative medicine that prevents you from getting in trouble. And that came out from a lot of my experience of like when my clients get into a lot of trouble, when they need litigation, right, which is the last thing we want to do. We're not a litigation firm. We don't like to do that. It's expensive, right? Most of our clients can't afford it. It's like, when it could have been avoided with that 15-minute phone call, to me, that's always been a shame. So I think we do really well as a law firm for e-commerce small businesses is that at a $99 a month program, we literally have made it, you know, as cheap as possible for you to get like that 15 minutes advice before you make a big major decision. And that 15 minutes, like Geico, it's like the Geico commercial, right? 15 minutes could save you from a lawsuit, right? Yeah,
right.
You know?
Wow. Awesome.
And that's what we try to do.
Definitely. And if our listeners are interested in checking that out, where could they find that?
So the program I'm talking about is actually called sellerbasics.com. It's about the basics, right? Just cover the Great. sellerbasics.com. And yeah, it's an easy sign up and the benefit is, yeah, you could talk to myself. We've got a whole network of attorneys. You have an SDA question, an FTC question, maybe sell a supplement, connect you with somebody who knows that stuff. You can get just a free quick call. And then if you want to go further, you go further. And then the other benefit is if you get suspended, if your ASIN gets taken down or your account gets shut down or you cover that, that's actually like an included benefit in this plan that we built. So we kind of built a cool little plan around Amazon to help people. Cause the other thing I hate is the $5,000 suspension. I think that is ridiculous, especially when the POAs are garbage. I've read some POAs that are just like, you know, I read one, I'm not going to criticize, I'm going to say who it was, but I read a POA not that long ago where by somebody who charges $5,000 for their suspension services. And it's like, you know, even the police tells you what you did wrong before they suspend you. I'm like, that's your best shot. Really? That's your $5,000. That's your $5,000 magic bullet right there. We do it a little differently. We put a lot of pressure on Amazon. We have a good working relationship. We know how the system works. We have very, very smart people who actually, in my opinion, probably 80% of Amazon issues should be resolved if you just really know how to read the details. And it's okay if you don't. It's not your job. Like, just run your business, you know? They're less than like $3 a day after tax deductions. We can do it all for you. And that's why I try to convince people. It's like really easy. Like, don't worry about it. But for those really unjust moments, yeah, we have our ways, right? We have our ways. You know, if I have to go to your congressperson, call them up and get them to tell Amazon to do the right thing, I'll do that. I will do whatever it takes. We go through hell or high water, we'll do whatever we can. Obviously, I can't guarantee anything, but people who know me know. That's what I do. We can't get in through the front door, we'll go through the back. We can't get through the back, we'll go down securely, we'll break through the window. Whatever it takes, we will get to that person and we will go, you know, through hell or high water for you. That's what my team is trained to do. And my team, one of the criteria is you actually have to care. Like, you can't not care. That's like my thing. Because I actually do. I take every case personally and they have to too. And they have to treat it like it's their own business. And so that's what we're like.
Sorry to interrupt the episode. You may have heard Ken and I talking recently about a new tool that we're using for Amazon refunds. Now, I have used other refund tools like this. However, I can tell you in the first 7 days, they scrubbed the back end of my Amazon account going back 18 months and found $5,000 of refunds. And the nice thing about this is it's my money. Amazon made a mistake and they are just auditing my account. The other thing I really like about this tool is there is no monthly fee. They only charge a commission if they are successful in getting you your money. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM for Firing the Man, FTM400. This is an awesome tool. Can't say enough good things about it. Now, back to the episode. Awesome. I think Ken and I are definitely interested in that service and probably would have been helpful a couple times this year where we had those small legal questions. And so to all of our listeners driving, we'll post that link down in the show notes. I want to get into sales tax, but before I ask my question, can we establish a working definition of nexus for people that are unfamiliar with that phrase or term?
If you're a podcast host or someone wanting to be interviewed on podcasts as a guest, visit podmatch.com. Podmatch automatically connects ideal podcast guests and hosts together for interviews. We always say it works just like a dating app, but instead of connecting you for dates, it connects you for podcast interviews. Podmatch has connected over 85,000 guests and hosts together for interviews that listeners love, all while saving you countless hours of administrative work through built-in automations. If you're ready to level up your podcast interviews on either side of the mic, start today by visiting podmatch.com.
We cannot establish a working definition of nexus. No, we cannot. But we can describe what it's meant to be.
There we go.
Okay. All right. So nexus is the constitution. So we have the Constitution of the United States of America, right? And let's say you're I'm here. Let's say I'm in New Jersey. I'm here in New Jersey, and something I did pissed off somebody in Alaska, and they want to sue me in Alaska. Okay. In order for me to be sued in Alaska in a court, I have to have some connection to the state of Alaska, some minimum connection. Maybe I was in Alaska and did something to that person to make them piss off at me, right? Maybe I did some business transaction with them. Even though I was here, I targeted them in Alaska and I did a transaction, right? Maybe there's something, but there has to be some minimum contact with the state of Alaska for them to sue me in Alaska. Now, they can only sue me in New Jersey, right? They can say I was wronged and they can say you're situated, right? But to bring me into Alaska, there has to be that minimum connection. Some, right? This is like civil procedure. You learn this in law school day one. This is the minimum contacts, right? That is for any lawsuit of any kind, including taxation lawsuit or just whether or not you're subject to tax. But when it comes to state and local tax, that wasn't enough. The courts, the Supreme Courts for 70 plus years have been concerned about small businesses being subject to the burden of 12,000 different state and local jurisdictions. And they said, you know, that standard nexus under the due process clause of the Constitution, the one I just mentioned earlier about the Alaska thing, we need a little bit more for the taxes, because that could really, like, could you imagine what that would do to a bunch of e-commerce small businesses if we had them all filing 12,000 tax returns like in the 90s? Would we be where we are today if that was the prerequisite, right? Oh. Imagine if in order to start your Amazon business, you had to register with 12,000 jurisdictions and pay sales and spend over $100,000 in filings. And I'm not talking about taxes. I'm just talking about like the cost to file the paper returns, right? Or electronic, right? It would be a deterrent. It would be a burden on interstate commerce. And that invokes what we call the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. And because Congress is, you know, because although Congress hasn't specifically addressed how e-commerce sellers should be protected, the Supreme Court has the right to invoke or the ability to invoke what's called the Dormant Commerce Clause and to say, well, even though Congress hasn't specifically said to want to protect this class, we're going to go ahead and assume that they probably would want to protect small businesses. And so they came up with a physical presence rule. And so for the longest time, and this is before e-commerce, the idea was you had to have physical presence in a state in order to have nexus. So you had to have some sort of physical tie to the state, right? So if you were just mailing catalogs through UPS, that wasn't enough. That wasn't physical, right? You had to have an employee, right? Maybe you had an office, right? Some physical connection to the state. The Supreme Court drew this bright line. And the last time they drew that bright line was originally the first time it was in the 60s, and they did it again. That was in Bellis Hess. And then they did it again in 1992 with the Quill case. Now, 1992 may have been the worst time to draw a line of commerce based on physicality, because what happened starting in 1992, the dawn of the internet and e-commerce. And all of a sudden, years later, huge companies like Amazon, right, and eBay were getting out of their tax obligations because they were saying, hey, there's this 1992 court case that says you have to be physically connected to a state in order to be subject to tax. And after years and years and years of hoping that Congress would finally pass some common sense internet tax laws that would, you know, just make universal sense, they didn't do it. Congress never passed those laws. They still haven't, right? There is something called the Internet Tax Freedom Act, which covers little things, which does actually help us out a little bit as sellers, but they never really comprehensively passed any laws. So in 2000, and we get to the Wayfair case, this famous case, which finally said, the Supreme Court said, you know what? Physical presence is a really stupid, bright line distinction for whether or not a business should be taxed, especially because Wayfair is a multi-billion dollar company. It's hard to imagine that the United States Congress is worried about burdening Wayfair, the billion-dollar company, out of business just by having to do the same taxes that their competitors like Walmart have to do. And so the court in 2018 said, we're no longer going to hold physical presence as the basis for which nexus, you know, you have to have nexus. It's no longer physical presence. And these states said, great, we have these ideas of thresholds that you have to do 200 transactions or $100,000 of sales or variations of that. The Supreme Court didn't necessarily say that there those are constitutional, because that's not what the court does. They just basically said that the old rule was no longer in effect. So they basically invalidated physical presence. And they said, you know, the new rules will be subject to new cases. So that's kind of where they left us. And when we said to the Supreme Court in that case, well, what about small businesses? You know, some of these thresholds aren't really that protective and this could really hurt small businesses. The Supreme Court said, great point. Wayfair is a really big company. And if you bring us a case in the small business, we'll consider that. So until then, we're all screwed. Like, and that's it. And so, in other words, until we bring a case to the Supreme Court with a small business, which we may be doing very soon, if they take it, it's just left up in the air. So every state just has their own interpretation of how Nexus works. And the only relief we got as Amazon sellers wasn't from Nexus, but it was from something else that we lobbied for through the Online Merchants Guild, which was the Marketplace Facilitator Laws, which you remember these, which is where at least officially Amazon would become a tax collector. So that if you were selling on Amazon, you at least would not be responsible for sales tax. And that took a lot of the burden off of small sellers. Do you remember when that happened?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
So that changed the game, but it also said, hey, if you want to sell on Shopify, that sucks because you're going to still have to be responsible for taxes. But at least on Amazon, you're not. So it actually deters a lot of people from having their own website, and it keeps people on platforms like Amazon and eBay. Unfortunately, it has done nothing for income tax because that is the new thing. So the long story short is we don't really know what Nexus is, but Nexus is the concept of Nexus for those listening who are just trying to understand is, you know, at first glance, you know, under our due process clause, Nexus is, you know, can I be sued in a state? And then because we care about overburdening small businesses, there is a second layer of nexus that is central for taxes called commerce clause taxes, commerce clause nexus. And that is, does my activity in this state significant enough to require me to participate in the taxing scheme, right? Whether that's paying income tax, property tax, sales tax, excise tax, use tax, franchise tax, or whatever baloney tax that they want to come up with. So that's kind of how it works. That's probably the best way I can explain it all.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's really, really helpful just to establish that. And so let me ask you this. As an Amazon seller, just talking about sales tax, what are you responsible for to stay compliant?
Okay, so at this point, every state except for perhaps, I believe Kansas, still may not. Have they? I don't know if they have yet, but just about every state will. The taxes are now being collected by Amazon and remitted by Amazon. And so sometimes they'll say, but you still have to file the tax return. I doubt it.
Okay.
Like if you don't, California, for example, will say, and every state has their approach, but California, for example, even California, the evil one, right, will say, if your only business activity is on Amazon, you do not need to even be registered for sales tax anymore.
Okay.
If your only business is with Amazon. Now, if you have a Shopify business, that's a different story. And some states say, well, what you're supposed to do is register and then report your Amazon sales as exempt sales or marketplace facilitator sales on the taxes. So if it's picked up as taxable, but at least it's being reported. But really, the way these laws are written is Amazon is officially the retailer now. Now, our argument was they were the retailer before the law changed too, but you know, there's a whole nother shady side to why that didn't happen. But the reality is that, you know, it is Amazon store. So you're not really responsible, generally speaking, for anything. And even if you were, like, what's the harm? Like, let's say the state of Alabama said, you should have filed a tax return in our state and you didn't. What did they not get by you not filing that tax return? If it's just sales tax, we're just talking about sales tax.
Yeah, I don't know. And what I'll say is, like, it seems like tax is kind of a scary thing, like, to a lot of people. They don't know
it is
what exactly they need to do to be compliant. You know, from a seller standpoint, you see that, like, on an invoice, you see the taxes coming on the sale, but you never see that cash. And so what we see is a lot of sellers don't do anything. And I think when you don't do anything, you have this little man in the back of your head saying, this may be an issue for you up the road. And so from what I'm understanding from you, based on how things are set up, if you're selling on Amazon, Amazon is taking care of that for you. Is that fair?
In just about every state, I believe, except for perhaps Kansas, and I believe that'll probably change in a very short future, maybe Missouri. But my guess is it's so immaterial. And we actually believe it's against the law for you to be responsible for the taxes on Amazon. This is one of our arguments in the Internet Tax Freedom Act. Because the Internet Tax Freedom Act says that that online stores must be taxed in the same manner as physical stores. And we say, look, Amazon's like a consignment store, right? I give them my inventory, but it's their cash register, it's their credit card, it's their customer. They're the ones charging my customer. So they're like the consignment store. And they, when I go to a consignment store in the middle of the city, I give them my inventory and I say, okay, you go sell it. They're responsible for the sales tax. It's their stores, their cash register, right? I just take whatever. They just say, hey, sold your stuff. Here's your money. Great. And that's how Amazon should work too, because that's the parody of the Internet Tax Freedom Act. And there's a million other versions of that example I can give. But consignment store is kind of the easiest one to follow. But you're right. People feel like there's a need to do something. But the good news is really with sales tax, there isn't. Now, should you maybe be doing something? Could you argue you might have to do something in Kansas or Missouri? Are the dollars that big? I mean, that's the other thing, right? Like, I mean, there are people who, you know, you may have to register to pay. Like Washington State, for example, will say you should still register and remit a tax return. Why? Because Washington State has a business and occupation tax. The business occupation tax is like, It's like 0.2%. It's something stupid small. Don't quote me on what it is, but Google it. It's a tiny percentage to where the average, you know, Amazon seller is probably going to owe like $30 a quarter and you'll spend, you know, $200 paying tax jar to figure it out. Right. It's just not even worth it. Right. Like, I mean, you have to use your brain and realize like the states are the ones who are acting out of order right now. And so like, unless it's your home state, where you live or where you have employees, we're not going off of anything, you know, just stick to, you know, but like I said, for the most part, when it comes to sales tax, because especially now, the last state to hold out that really mattered was Florida. That was July of 2021, right? Like Florida is typically every Amazon seller's what, like second or third largest state, depending on whether they're self boats or not, right? So Florida took a while to get there, but at this point, pretty much any state that matters, the tax is being collected by Amazon by law, and it's being remitted by Amazon. And it is Amazon's responsibility, primary responsibility as a taxpayer, to remit those taxes under what's called the Marketplace Facilitator Law. And if you Google Marketplace Facilitator Law, you'll probably see like TaxJar and Avalar will have these like color-coded maps, and they'll show you exactly what year the state became marketplace facilitator. The last thing I would recommend most sellers do is just go out and blindly register in a bunch of states. Like that's the last thing you want to do, especially without talking to somebody first. And when I say somebody, I don't mean to be self-serving, but talk to me, talk to a lawyer. Don't talk to TaxJar or Avalara because their answer is always you need to register. Like, yeah. I'm being a little bit facetious, but I'm not. But like you know, they convince companies that are making like 60 grand a year in profit that they need to register in every state, and that will bankrupt. That will destroy you. You just don't understand what it's like to be registered in those states, because it isn't going to end at sales tax. It's income tax too. And it's not like, you're like, well, you know, income tax. Let's say I pay $10,000 of income tax to the state of Oregon, you know, and now 49 or 45 other states want my income tax. Well, do I have to pay all of it to them? Well, technically there's a division mechanism, so you don't have double tax. So you're not even really even going to be, it's not you necessarily going to be paying a lot more tax because of this, but the filing fees, I mean, having to file a tax, I mean, think how much your accountant charges you just to file a tax return to the IRS and to your state, and then just, you know, extrapolate that by 50 or something, you know what I mean? It gets expensive. It's just, it's an unreasonable ask that you should have to spend $500 or $700 on a Mississippi tax return just so you can remit $20 to Mississippi. It's just idiotic. So right now we're in a world where we have to use our like materiality hats and common sense hats because the states aren't. And we have constitutional protections behind us here. That's the difference. And we can rely on solid constitutional arguments for our positions. And because of that, it's not like tax evasion. And I know Wesley Snipes went to jail for similar arguments, but if you have any concerns about the constitutional law, read our Pennsylvania, read the online merchant's guild case in Pennsylvania that we just won. We just proved that there is no tax obligation for you simply because Amazon puts your inventory in some state. So don't start thinking that you have an obligation. Now, does that mean for sure 100% every other state should take that position? No. Should they? Well, yeah, they should, because it's the federal constitution, not the Pennsylvania constitution. But, you know, state courts can differ and this thing could go to the Supreme Court, or a variation could. But my point is, the fact that an appellate court in Pennsylvania looked at our fact pattern and said, yeah, Amazon is not Nexus. Amazon in and of itself is not Nexus, should give you comfort that you should be able to use your common sense hat, not just your, you know, don't just be afraid because the government says one thing that you have to do what the government says. You can use your common sense and your materiality hat to decide what to do. And this is what, yeah, this is something we offer when you give us a call. And you want to schedule a consultation with us through our seller basis program, so we'll sit down and chat with you about that. You know, we can, you know, spend 20 minutes going over your business and seeing if there's any reason why you should be worried about registering somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. I'll tell you what, I think we could talk to you all day about this, but want to definitely be respectful of your time. So, Ken, I'm going to turn it over to you for the fire round.
Yep, absolutely.
All right.
Let me pull up here. Paul, are you ready for the fire round?
No, but you were going to do this anyway. We're going to go.
What is your favorite book?
What is my favorite book? Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell.
Awesome.
That's a great one.
What are your hobbies?
Okay, what are my hobbies? I love video games and flight simulators. And I used to like running until I hurt myself. I'm not much of a runner anymore. So I'll stick with that. Also just like playing with my kids and watching TV. And just, in fact, I hate reading. I like listening to audiobooks because I read so much as a lawyer. Actually, opening a book to read annoys me. I have to listen to it.
What is one thing that you do not miss about working for the man?
What is one thing I do not miss about working for the man? Office politics. It's just brutal. And just the sense of like being on somebody else's schedule.
Cool. Last one. What do you think sets apart successful e-commerce entrepreneurs from those who give up, fail, or never get started?
People, I think it's fear. I think it's just getting out. You got to get over the fear. And I think it's fear of failing. I think you have to be fully willing to fail, accept failure as a learning mechanism when you do fail, if you do fail, and be willing to pick yourself up and get down. I mean, you really got to be willing to go for growth. And that doesn't mean be stupid with your ass. Like, I'm not saying like take out a home equity loan on your house and bet it all on, that's not what I'm saying. But like, you know, I think you really have to just take action. People, it's analysis paralysis, right? People just think about it all day. And the last thing I'll say, I think people make big mistakes is I think, and of course I'm going to say this as a service provider, but I really see this in a lot of ways. Like, let me give an example, EPC. Okay. Do you guys offer PPC services? I don't want to be or anything like that.
We don't. No.
Okay.
All right. So I don't think I'll sold it. Hey, have you ever been to a PPC conference? Like you ever been to one of them? Have you ever seen like a PPC presentation?
Yeah, yeah, we're like, pretty well.
The really good ones. It's like data science. And I talk to people who are like, you're not a data scientist. Like if I had an Amazon business, if I were starting an Amazon business and I were building a brand and I wanted, like I would find the best person to run my PPC. I would not figure it because I know my weakness, like knowing your strengths and weaknesses. And like, I'm not a data scientist. Why are there so many people in this room trying to learn this PPC thing? It's just like, to me, it bothers me because, you know, people like Richard Branson always say like the key to success is knowing what to delegate, right? Knowing what and when to delegate. And I feel like Amazon sellers, you know, and I get it because everyone's out to fleece us. Everyone's out to get us. Everyone's out to say that they're the best at this. And a lot of times they suck. So I get it. And like, nobody wants to get burned. And believe me, I got burned too. My first year in business, I got burned by people offering me Google ads, like, you know, who knew, right? And searchable websites. So like, I've been there, but I feel like we have to delegate, like you have to do it. So I don't know. I think there's a fear and there's a failure to delegate. There's a common things and the failure to learn from others, you know, because I think people, my clients who oftentimes are struggling, I'll tell them things I know just because I'll know 10 other sellers who are doing it. I'm like, where were you? So it's like, they're just not in the loop and they're not, you know, so be social, go to the conferences, talk to people, learn, you know, be out there, you know, don't be afraid to learn from others or take advantage. So I guess those are my picks. Sorry, those are good. That's good.
Those are very good.
Excellent. Yeah. So, yeah, Paul, David, I can't do the one word answer. Sorry. I'm too chatty.
It's all good. You're a great podcaster. So,
yeah.
Paul, thank you so much for being a guest on our podcast. And we're looking forward to staying in touch. We're going to have you back on because there's some things we didn't get to today and definitely want to cover those in future episodes. So, thank you so much.
I absolutely would love to come back on anytime
you want. This is a lot of fun. I'm excited for more fire round questions. So, that was fun.
Got it.
So you tell me when and where and I'll be there, guys. Absolutely love hanging out with you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you everyone for tuning in to today's Firing the Man podcast. If you like this episode, head on over to firingtheman.com and check out our resource library for exclusive Firing the Man discounts on popular e-commerce subscription services. That is firingtheman.com/resource. You can also find a comprehensive library of over 50 books that Ken and I have read in the last few years that have made a meaningful impact on our business. For that, head on over to www.firingtheman.com/library. Lastly, check us out on social media at Firing the Man and on YouTube at Firing the Man for exclusive content. This is David Schomer
and Ken Wilson.
We're out. Before you go, we wanted to share a new service that Ken and I have been using called Getida that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, Getida.com, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for Firing the Man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?